Jenna Fisher.
And I'm Angela Kinsey.
And together we have the podcast Office Ladies.
Just because we finished rewatching The Office does not mean we're going anywhere.
Every Wednesday, we'll be sharing even more exclusive stories from The Office and our friendship with brand new guests. Plus, you can revisit all the Office Ladies rewatch episodes every Monday with new bonus tidbits before every episode.
So follow and listen to Office Ladies on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
Why get all your holiday decorations delivered through Instacart? Because maybe you only bought two wreaths, but you have 12 windows. Or maybe your toddler got very eager with the advent calendar. Or maybe the inflatable snowman didn't make it through the snowstorm. Or maybe the twinkle lights aren't twinkling. Whatever the reason, this season, Instacart's here for hosts and their whole holiday haul. Get decorations from the Home Depot, CVS, and more through Instacart and enjoy free delivery on your first three orders. Service fees and terms apply.
It is Wednesday morning, November 13th, and it's going to be a rainy day today. 70% chance for showers. I think they're saying around 11 o'clock or something like that. It's going to come in through the afternoon and highs of 80. But then a front comes through, and thankfully tomorrow we'll see the sunshine again. Highs of 74 tomorrow, then lows Thursday night, Friday morning around 55. Highs of only 70 on Friday, and we're in the 70s through Sunday. Back to the 80s, lower 80s by Monday, upper 70s by Tuesday with a chance for showers, and maybe we'll start getting some fronts that come through. Dane Cialino joins us now, our friend, professor of law at Loyola, to talk about the Ten Commandments situation and what the judge says and what Jeff Landry wants to do. Morning, Dane. How are you?
Morning, Tommy. Just fine.
I guess maybe we should start with the facts of the case. How about that? That sounds professorial, doesn't it?
It does indeed. Yeah, the Louisiana legislature in its last session passed a bill that required the posting of the Ten Commandments in public school classrooms across the state. As soon as it became law with Jeff Landry's signature, the law was challenged by some plaintiffs saying that the new law violated the First Amendment's Establishment Clause. And the matter has been pending in federal court in Baton Rouge since then. Yesterday, the district judge presiding over the case, granted the plaintiff's motion for a preliminary injunction and enjoined the state from enforcing that law, saying that the First Amendment and its Establishment Clause were violated by the by requiring school children to have to see the Ten Commandments in their classroom. So basically, we have yet another Louisiana law being struck down by the federal courts as being unconstitutional.
So let's talk about what the Constitution says. Let me take a step back, Dane. When it comes to this step, was this ruling, was it surprising that it would happen at this juncture? And is the whole plan to get to the next step, the next court?
Yeah, not a surprise at all. I think everybody expected the plaintiffs to win and the state to lose at this stage in the district court because there's a 1980 U.S. Supreme Court opinion that addresses this exact issue that says that that the First Amendment doesn't permit this sort of legislation. Now, what's different and the end game for the state, the attorney general and the governor has always been to get this to the United States Supreme Court in hopes that the Supreme Court is going to revisit its existing precedent in this area and overrule it and find that the First Amendment is not offended by this sort of statute. And while I think everybody expected them to lose at this stage and everyone expects them to lose at the next stage at the first appeal, it's anybody's guess what might happen when it gets to the Supreme Court.
There was a difference, right, in the approach as far as what was the distinction Liz Merle's trying to make with this as opposed to other Ten Commandment rulings you and I had spoken about before, I think?
Yeah. I mean, for the last 40 or 50 years, the court has used what's known as the Lemon versus Kurtzman test for evaluating whether statutes violate the First Amendment, which is a kind of a more complicated test that balances the secular purpose versus the religious purpose of a ordinance or statute. And the court threw that out about 3 or 4 years ago in favor of a history and tradition test, that if a practice that does have some religious effect is grounded in history and tradition, that it still would be okay under the First Amendment. That's what the argument is going to be when the state gets to the Supreme Court, that as a matter of history and tradition, there's been kind of a long history and a long tradition of having the Ten Commandments posted, at least a long history before the U.S. Supreme Court adopted the Lemon versus Kurtzman test. I don't want to get too technical with everyone, but that's basically what it is.
So when it comes to, you know, people saying, doesn't the governor, doesn't the attorney general have better things to do with their time? When it comes to, defending a case like this, because now, well, plaintiff, which side are they on? There would be the defendant,
the state,
right?
Is the defendant. Right.
Yeah. When it comes to defending this, what kind of resources are we talking about? Are these people that are on staff that would be doing this anyway, so it really doesn't cost anything more? Does it cost the state money to do this? I'm just trying to figure out how all of this works. Are there court costs involved?
Oh, yeah, there's no doubt that this costs the state money. If the state loses, the state is going to have to pay the attorney's fees of the prevailing plaintiffs. So nothing's free, and the state will wind up having to pay, of course, all the lawyers defending it. But at the end of the day, they're going to have to pay all of the plaintiff's lawyers who brought the case because of the unconstitutional conduct.
All right, let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back, 504-260-1870. And I would just ask you, the audience, you can text me and let me know what you think. And I know everybody's all, you know, let's put the Ten Commandments up and it sounds great and everything else. But do you really think that it's going to make a difference, that people are going to look at the Ten Commandments, that the kids that are troubled in school, that the parents aren't keeping an eye on them, that posting the Ten Commandments is going to make a difference? Do you really think that this is going to do anything other than boost, and I'm just calling it for what it is, Dane, you can stay out of this, but boost the right cred of the far-right cred, whatever you call it, of Liz Merle and Jeff Landry? Because it just seems to me to be silly. Because I grew up and went to Catholic school my whole life, high school, up to high school. They never had the Ten Commandments posted in the classroom. They talked about it, but that had nothing to do with the way I was raised. It was the way my parents raised me, and it just seems like a big waste of time and money for somebody to promote their own political career. But you can text me, let me know what you think. That's my opinion. I'm entitled to it. You can text me yours at 504-260-1870. 621 now, traffic, WWL. All right, 626, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Dane Cialino, professor of law at Loyola, about the Ten Commandments ruling. And I asked you to text in. Somebody texted in, said, Jeff Landry's on a power trip. Why don't you put a tiger in every classroom? I get the sarcasm there. As a high school teacher, this is a waste of time and money that could have been spent better on schools. Somebody texted in, good morning, Tommy. Ask the professor how this law affects increasing amount of Muslim and other religions' backgrounds. And somebody else texted in and said that, well, if they put the Ten Commandments up, I want the Quran or quotes from the Quran listed in the classroom as well. Does that open a can of worms? And ultimately, when you talk about the Ten Commandments, although it's not specifically Christian, does that open the door for other religions that want to be represented?
All very good points, showing the problems with doing just what the legislature has done.
So how do you see this playing out, or do you have any idea, given the choice of the or at least given the makeup of the Supreme Court, I guess?
Yeah, right now, yesterday's opinion was technically just a preliminary ruling pending the formal final trial on the merits. But I would expect that both parties are going to ask the judge to convert this preliminary injunction into a permanent injunction, enter a final judgment so the matter could go straight to the Fifth Circuit in New Orleans. The Fifth Circuit will deliberate the case for at least another 6-8 months. And it won't even be presented to the Supreme Court for probably another year. But once it gets there, I would think it's got some chance of prevailing if the court takes that history and tradition approach. But the court may not want to revisit that existing precedent and may just apply stare decisis and say, we're just going to leave this alone. The court, though, has shown willingness to overturn longstanding precedents, most famously overturning Roe versus Wade in the Dobbs opinion a couple of years ago. But, you know, I would be surprised if the court would readdress this under their new approach to the Establishment Clause, but you never know.
Somebody texted in and said, what if the state wins? Do the plaintiffs pay?
No, it's a one-way street for payment in these civil rights cases under Section 1988 of the United States Code, that the prevailing plaintiffs can win their costs, but not the other way around.
Thank you, Dane. Appreciate your time as always. Dane Cialino, professor of law at Loyola. Some of the other texts that are coming in, will it hurt in any way if the commandments are posted? No, it won't hurt, but why don't you paint every classroom orange? That's not going to hurt either, and it's going to cost money. Somebody else texted and said, believing in going to church will make you a Christian. It's like believing standing in a garage will make you a car. Somebody else texted and said, conservatives always push the narrative that Democrats are always trying to force an agenda on you. That's a prime example of forcing an agenda on you. Somebody else said the status quo isn't working. Well, no, we do have problems with juvenile crime and juveniles doing what they're supposed to do. But I think it's a quantum leap to say that posting the Ten Commandments in the classroom is going to help. And again, my thing is, if you believe in the Constitution, you believe in the Constitution, and you can't morph it and change it into what you want and not what the other person doesn't want, right? I mean, if it says Congress shall make no law Congress shall make no law establishing a religion, well, then adhere to that and teach religion in a private school or teach religion at home. At least that's the way I see it. We'll take a break, come back, talk about the mayoral race in New Orleans right now. Time for WWL First News. 6:45, quarter till 7, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Ed Shervinak, our friend, professor of political science at my alma mater, UNO. How you doing, Ed?
I'm doing well, Tommy. How are you today?
I'm okay. Let's talk about the timing of the mayoral race and how much time LaToya Cantrell has left as mayor of New Orleans.
Sure. Well, she's entering the last year of her tenure, and so she's basically entering lame duck status. And so now people are jockeying to replace her come next October. It'll be October 2025 when we have the mayoral race.
So the first question is, why would anybody, and I'm not trying to be flippant when I say this, Ed, but when you look at the problems that the city has, boy, talk about endless, glamorless, thankless job, and in no way am I defending LaToya Cantrell, but you better watch what you ask for because you may just get it, right?
That's absolutely right. It's a tough job, but, you know, people believe that they want to serve, and they feel that they can make a difference, and so they think they can bring their people in, they can bring their ideas in, and change the direction of the city.
So let's look at it two ways. So you just said it. You want to serve. You care about the city. You want to do what's best for New Orleans, and you bleed purple, gold, and green, and you're willing to take on the job. On the other hand, are there any benefits? Where do you go after you are mayor of New Orleans long term, if somebody has long term political ambitions?
You know, the record for post mayoral careers in New Orleans is not very good. We see Mark Morial as head of the Urban League. You know, Mitch Landrieu working for the Biden administration in Washington, D.C. But outside of that, we don't see a lot of success by former mayors. They pretty much don't have much future in Louisiana politics. We're a Democratic city in a fiery red state. So it's very limited in terms of what they can do, at least in terms of what we've seen so far.
So the point I was trying to make is you're not really, if you are running for mayor, you would think you're doing it because you care about the city and you want to make a difference, because it's not really going to be a launching pad to anything, is it?
No, it's not typically a launching pad. It, you know, being a mayor, you know, you could move on to be governor, you know, and of course every governor believes they can be the next president. But, you know, that's probably just not going to happen here in Louisiana.
But New Orleans, Orleans Parish, is a blue island in a red sea, correct?
That is correct. We are a blue dot in what someone termed a fiery red state.
Fiery red state. So let's talk about who some of the contenders are. I believe Helena Moreno, no surprises, already announced. Is that right?
She hasn't formally announced, but certainly it's not the best kept secret is that she wants to run. She's been holding fundraisers. She's been hiring people for her campaign team, her consultants, her media people, her pollsters. So we can expect her to announce probably sometime soon. Other names that are out there, Councilmember Oliver Thomas from District E, he's making some noise about running. Also, State Senator Royce DePlessis is also considering whether it makes sense for him to run or not. We've got a couple of long shots. The Nooney man, Belden Badiste, said he's going to run a self-funded mayoral campaign. And Ricky Twiggs, a licensed counselor, he announced his candidacy earlier as well.
How would this compare and contrast to the last mayoral campaign, Ed?
Well, the last campaign, we had an incumbent mayor, so...
I misspoke. Before that, the last time we didn't have an incumbent mayor, because it's in Orleans Parish, if you're an incumbent, you're pretty well guaranteed a second term almost, right?
Almost, yeah. Historically speaking, we've never denied an incumbent mayor a second term. Well, you know, a lot of people feel that the city's at a crossroads right now, that, you know, we can continue spiraling down, losing population, not being a magnet for business, or that someone can come in and change things, change the culture in City Hall, get City Hall to work, be able to negotiate with corporate heads, bring in businesses to New Orleans to make it a more economically viable and dynamic city.
All right, let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back, talk about some other names possible. I know Helena Moreno does have experience not only as a council member, but a representative, state representative. We'll talk about how she would stack up against potential contenders. And are there any other names that are flying beneath the radar, somebody you might think of that would have a chance of becoming the next mayor of the city of New Orleans? 6:50, 10 till 7, traffic now, WWL. 6:56, 4 till 7, Natalie J. Rowe joins. I'm Tommy Tucker, WWL. Natalie J. Rowe joins us, our friend, president, CEO of Second Harvest Food Bank, talking about the Thanksgiving meal drive goal that's going on at Second Harvest. How you doing, Natalie?
I'm great, Tommy. How are you doing?
I am okay, and I'm thrilled to have you on because, and I tell this story often, I know somebody that is besieged with offers for charities, and they say the only one to give to is Second Harvest. Nothing against any other charities, because they know it's going to be used to feed hungry people and it's not going to be wasted.
So, well, that's so good to hear. We're so grateful that the community trusts us to do this work for them.
Tell me about the food drive.
Well, this Thanksgiving, we've got more than 24 events going on across our communities. And that includes giving away more than 3,000 turkeys and holiday boxes, all kinds of sponsors like Chevron, Sempre, Ochsner, People's Health. We'll be doing meals for seniors at community centers across South Louisiana with People's Health. Just so many exciting and festive things happening, and we're so grateful for all these donors that make this happen for us. Also, we've got a match, so that for any donations that you give us from November 11th through 28th, they will be doubled by an anonymous donor, and then we have Giving Tuesday on Tuesday, December 3rd. So lots of things happening. It's always a busy time of year. We're so grateful that people think about their neighbors.
Let's talk about volunteering. Do you need help, especially during Thanksgiving?
Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh. We need more than 200 volunteers a day to do what we do, starting in the morning at 6 a.m. when we pack meals for our seniors across 5 councils on aging. Then we move on to preparing meals for children for after-school programs. But we're also packing 20,000 boxes every month for seniors across South Louisiana. We do all of that with our volunteers. So please, 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 if you have time, come to be with us. And then, of course, at all the distributions where we'll be at the Lower Ninth and guest homes and other places, we always welcome volunteers to help us.
How do people find out about volunteering and finding shifts that are open, or how do they go about it, vetting, et cetera, Natalie?
Yes, if they will just go onto our website at no-hunger.org, that will take them directly to our volunteer page where they can sign up for a shift. So it's made easy for everyone. It will give you all the details of the things that we're doing. And by the way, if you know someone that needs help, please direct them to that website also. We have a map on that website that shows where our partner is in the neighborhood closest to you. So please, if you're involved with Second Harvest or know someone that needs our help, please come to our website at no-hunger.org.
Somebody texted in specifically about Thanksgiving Day. Are you in need of volunteers for Thanksgiving Day?
You know, most of our partners want to do the distributions before Thanksgiving Day because we actually are handing out boxes and turkeys that people cook for the day. So, but we also have other partners that are doing Thanksgiving Day distributions. And I would say OZNMN is probably doing something like that. You can certainly come onto our website and we can direct you to our partners that will actually be open on Thanksgiving Day.
Thank you, Natalie. Happy Thanksgiving.
Why get all your holiday decorations delivered through Instacart? Because maybe you only bought two wreaths, but you have 12 windows. Or maybe your toddler got very eager with the advent calendar. Or maybe the inflatable snowman didn't make it through the snowstorm. Or maybe the twinkle lights aren't twinkling. Whatever the reason, this season, Instacart's here for hosts and their whole holiday haul. Get decorations from the Home Depot, CVS, and more through Instacart and enjoy free delivery on your first three orders. Service fees and terms apply.
I'm Jenna Fisher.
And I'm Angela Kinsey.
And together we have the podcast Office Ladies.
Just because we finished rewatching The Office does not mean we're going anywhere.
Every Wednesday, we'll be sharing even more exclusive stories from The Office and our friendship with brand new guests. Plus, you can revisit all the Office Ladies rewatch episodes every Monday with new bonus tidbits before every episode.
So follow and listen to Office Ladies on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, 7:14, you heard Peyton Malone say we got some bad weather coming in later on today around 11 o'clock, and not terrible, but just be aware of it. Years ago, I was with my kid at Parkway Bakery and Tavern getting a po' boy, and a young man wearing a cap, we're just sitting there eating our sandwich outside, brought some shrimp, a plate of fried shrimp to us, and he had no idea who I was, and he said, "Here, try these out." And I don't think I had a shrimp po' boy at the time, but subsequent to that, I realized that Parkway had the best shrimp that I had in the city ever, fried shrimp. And with that, we welcome in Justin Kennedy, General Manager, Parkway Bakery and Tavern. The young man that brought me those shrimp was Justin Kennedy, I found out later. How you doing, Justin?
Wow, Tommy, I didn't know I did that.
Yes, you did. Absolutely, sir. That just, man, said volumes about you and about Parkway and everything else, because we were just sitting there eating our sandwich and you brought a plate of fried shrimp and you said, "Here, try these." And my kid said,
When I do that from time to time, it's sometimes I'll pick up a sandwich and they're making them so fast.
Uh-huh.
One might not weigh as much as I think it should. And I'm like, no, I got to go hit these guys on the back end. And it probably wasn't even an issue. It probably wasn't even light.
No, it was just a nice thing for you to do. And my kid even said, "Did he know who you were?" I said, "Well, first of all, I'm not a big deal." But I said, "No, I don't think at all. He was just being nice." And he was just being nice. Speaking of being nice, I got to check in my wallet for the Al Copeland Foundation, because I have always wanted to get involved with what you do. I think it's a huge deal. Tell me what's going on before Thanksgiving every Wednesday, Justin, at Parkway.
Sure. I mean, I'm here right now. When I open these cooler doors, I got a couple of guys here right now getting ready. I mean, it's forget the shrimp and roast beef. You open the cooler doors, it's packed with turkey, stuffing, gravy, cranberry sauce, and we get rid of all of it before 5 o'clock today. And I started this years ago, probably 2008, I started this sandwich just to have fun with it. And it turned into a phenomenon where it's just people look forward to it every year. It really marks the season of Thanksgiving for a lot of people. They come out. I mean, it's lawn chairs out here Wednesday. I mean, people are going to start showing up any minute, waiting in line. And it got so busy. I'm thinking, this thing is so unique. How can I harbor this for something more than just people coming to Parkway and eating a turkey sandwich? And it's exactly what I did, partnering up with the Al Copeland Foundation, Al Copeland Jr. As you know, his dad was the Chicken King, mm-hmm. and he passed of Merkel cell carcinoma, which was a rare skin cancer. And back at the time, 2008, it was a death wish. You couldn't get a cure. And if anyone could afford to get a cure, it was Big Al. And he ended up passing away in cancer, looking for that cure. And his son said, look, I'm a starter foundation. I vow to end that cancer that killed my father. And look, you fast forward years later. I mean, that's exactly what he did. He saved many people from that same cancer. And I got introduced to him, and I said, you know what? This sandwich is going to help you raise money for that cancer foundation. And like, the gimmick is the line down the street, donate to the Al Copeland Foundation, skip the line. And when you skip the line, you come up to a little booth area right here, right when you come in the gate at Parkway. And you get the sandwich, you get a T-shirt, you get a chance to spin the wheel that has all kind of merch and swag from some sponsors, which is really cool. I want to get to, and sweet potato fries, and then you get a Creole cream cheese ice cream from New Orleans Ice Cream Company, and all that money goes to cancer. So,
that's a lot
of money. Yeah, fight against cancer, right. To the Al Copeland Foundation, right. And if you don't have that kind of money to spend for lunch or donate, look, just get in line. It moves quick. And Parkway is going to write a big fat check to the foundation after this is all over with.
I got a check in my wallet, and I'm going to make it for more than I said I was going to, because I didn't realize, I know you guys are going to send some sandwiches over. We appreciate that. But I didn't realize there's a T-shirt, so I'm going to need a medium T-shirt, Justin, just so you know.
I got you,
and
man.
I'll up the donation. I promise I will. Tell me about the sandwich itself.
So the sandwich itself, we start working on making it probably the Saturday before, because mm-hmm. it takes days to prep for this one thing. So first thing we do is we roast the turkeys, and they're whole birds, just like at the house, you know, leg on, 20-pound birds. And after we roast those turkeys, we cut the breast off, we take the dark meat off, we take the bones, throw it in a big pot with a mirepoix, carrot, celery, onion, and make a nice stock with that. And with that stock, we make the gravy for it. And then we make the rich stock for the stuffing, that we make a cornbread dressing, and then put that dark meat in the dressing. Then we slice that white meat breast we cut off and put that on top. And then we make a homemade cranberry sauce. So it's a lot of work. It's a labor of love. And like I said, it takes 3 or 4 days to prep for a few hours of service on Wednesday.
Is this your creation, Justin? Did you come up with this, where you got the whole Thanksgiving dinner on a po' boy?
You know, it was a guy named Randy that worked for me years ago. Mm-hmm. He had that nice Ward accent. Yeah, hey, bruh, it was Thanksgiving time. He's like, Justin, you know what? You know, we need to come up with a Thanksgiving po' boy, man. And like, years after he had left, he revisited me like a little person on my shoulder, and I started to do it. And at the time, we didn't have the space to cook these turkeys, because all our ovens, we got plenty of ovens here, but they're all dedicated for roast beef 24/7. And the little time I had to cook turkeys, we would run out at like 1-2 o'clock. And like I said, it got so insane. You run out when there's a line. You can't have that. You know, that'll happen once or twice, and you'll learn how to fix that problem.
Let me take a break, Justin, because we got to get traffic in, and we're gonna pick it up when we come back. All right? Because I think
and
you got a guy at the counter from New York. Is he still there or not?
Yeah, he's still here. He come with the place.
There you go. I think you are an amazing story. I think you're like as naturally New Orleans as New Orleans can be. Justin Kennedy, General Manager, Parkway Bakery and Tavern. We'll talk about the nuts and bolts of getting your Thanksgiving po' boy and contributing to the Al Copeland Foundation when we come back. It has become a New Orleans phenomenon. It really has. 721 traffic now, WWL. 726, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Justin Kennedy, General Manager of Parkway Bakery and Tavern. They got the Thanksgiving sandwiches going where it's all on one. What do you call it, Justin, the official name of it?
We call it the Thanksgiving Po' Boy.
Thanksgiving Po' Boy, and rightfully so, because everything you want for Thanksgiving is on it, and the money that they raise, they make a donation to the Al Copeland Foundation to fight skin cancer. And if you want to skip the line and people set up, because it is a New Orleans tradition, a Thanksgiving tradition, if you pay $100, you get to skip the line, right? And you get a T-shirt, sweet potato fries, Arnold Palmer, and a Creole cream cheese ice cream sandwich.
That's it. That's it. And then you can say, hey, all that money went to fighting cancer.
There you go. I wanted to ask you about celebrities in there, because it seems like every time I'm in there, I see a celebrity. What are some of the people, big celebrities that have been in Parkway?
We've had a few over the years. We had our President Obama's been here.
He was not there when I was in there. Justin Long was in there. A little bit of a difference.
I mean, there's been a ton of celebrities. Sandra Bullock. I mean, it's to ask me off cuff. Sandra Bullock's been here. One night, late night. Who was the star of Baywatch? David Hasselhoff busting and like he was a character. Anyways,
had he been drinking?
But it might have seemed that way.
Yeah.
But one thing about this place, man, I'll never like. If you walk in the Parkway. There's been people, but we never run and go grab a picture with them or anything like that. We never put pictures on the wall of people who's been here because I don't want to. I mean, nothing wrong with that.
No,
that's
but I
cool.
get it. And when I was there, you know, you got the communal tables. Justin Long was just sitting there eating a sandwich. And I'm trying to think. I can't think of the other name that was there eating at the time, a different time when I was there. But it was a celebrity because my kid pointed him out. And again, nobody bothered him for autographs or anything else. I did say when I was walking by, you Justin Long? Yeah. Okay. I'll enjoy your sandwich.
And I think that's just testament to the Po' Boy sandwich. You know, it grabs all walks of life, 8 to 80, young, old, rich, poor, everyone like comes together for this sandwich. I mean, that's what it is.
Well, I think it's your place too, because I think y'all have done a great job with that, with the outdoor area, pet friendly out there. The inside is nice. The communal tables. I can't say enough about it. It's my favorite Po' Boy place. It is, no disrespect to anybody else. Tell me, when are you going to be serving this Thanksgiving Po' Boy? It's only on Wednesdays. This Wednesday.
Only on Wednesday, and we have three of them. We have this one. We have the next Wednesday, and the day before Thanksgiving, which is the busiest. And you can, you know, we're 538 Hagen Avenue is the location with us. We're right on Bayou St. John in Mid-City. And you can show up at 10 o'clock. Doors open at 10. You can buy it as normal. But if you want to wait and you want to donate to cancer, you can go to parkwaypoorboys.com. That's our website. Hit the link, and you can buy a ticket. And you can just pick your Wednesday you want to come. It's really cool this year. You know, we raise about $10,000 usually, and over the 7 years we've been doing it, we've raised a little over $100,000. But last year we had our official sponsor, and it was Crystal Hot Sauce. Threw a good bit of money at this thing, and it all went to cancer. And you know, and we're a good partnership with them. Well, this year, Crystal Hot Sauce, Blue Plate Mayo, and Leidenheimer Baking Company has all donated the same amount to the foundation. So I think when it's all said and done, I think we'll raise close to $40,000 with this sandwich.
That's awesome, and I'm going to help as much as I can. Justin Long, I'm just calling you Justin Long. Justin Kennedy, thanks for taking the time with us. You got a great place there. Look, Jordan and I, you know, we talk to people from all over that, and we book guests, people from all over the country. Whenever they ask us where to go to New Orleans, where you want a local place, a real place, we always send them to Parkway because that's the real deal. Thank you, my friend.
Hey, and tell them to ask for me. If we're open, I'm here.
All right, I will. Thank you, Justin.
All right, Tommy.
Have a good day. Happy Thanksgiving. Justin Kennedy, General Manager, Parkway Bakery and Tavern. You can go to Parkway Poor Boys. You got to spell it, PoorBoys.com, and get your ticket and help the Al Copeland Foundation doing it this Wednesday, the following Wednesday, and the Wednesday after that. And I'll try to remember the next two Wednesdays. We'll take a break, come back, talk to Richard Nelson, Louisiana Revenue Secretary, about the governor's tax reform plan. Minute late, time now, WWL First News. 7:45, quarter till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWL, joined by Richard Nelson, Louisiana Revenue Secretary, talk about the special session that is unfolding and the governor's tax reform plan. Good morning, Richard. How are you?
Good. Thanks for having me.
Tell me where you stand now with the special session and where you thought you'd be and how your original plan, and I said you were the architect of it, I think that's accurate, has changed or morphed, has it?
I think it's still pretty much intact. I mean, I think we've been kind of constantly making amendments, but that's, I think, expected almost with any legislation, let alone, you know, this is a lot of moving parts. I think our original package we sent out to the legislators was about 500 pages, so there is a lot in there. But we're about right on track to where we want to be. We're about a little bit less than halfway through the session, and we passed the first couple bills out through the House yesterday, and they're headed over to the Senate. We have a few more bills in the committee this morning, in the Ways and Means Committee, the Tax Committee on the House this morning, and hopefully we'll get those bills through the House by the end of the week and over to the Senate so that we can go through the Senate committees and the Senate floor next week.
I get a couple of texts here from people, and you can address this in general. Basically, what they're saying is you're just moving money around. You lower a tax on one side, then you add a tax on the other side, so is there really a difference? Take me through the plan and what the goal is here, Richard, if you would.
Sure. So Louisiana has a very uncompetitive tax code. It's not that we tax people too much, really. It's really that we really just make it as difficult as possible in order to raise that revenue. And that's really what I think really holds us back. You know, we have a lot of taxes that are really uncompetitive that most other states have gotten rid of or phased out. And so what we're trying to do is, one, give a tax cut. So we actually do, you know, reduce the state revenue by hundreds of millions of dollars. So that is, there is an actual reduction in state revenue. But we do that, I say, in a smart way, in that we're trying to raise the money in from, you know, not taxing people's income. We're trying to use some funds that currently are locked up in the Constitution, some to pay down debt, some to just give the legislature more flexibility so that we can give some tax cuts with some of this recurring corporate money that we've been just kind of piling up over the last couple of years. We put like $3 billion in our savings accounts or more over the last couple of years. And so we, you know, like to use that to give people some tax cuts and I think just have more responsible budgeting. And so it's relatively complicated, but it is a net tax cut. Everybody in the state will have a net income tax reduction. They'll see more money in their paychecks. But it is just trying to simplify the system so that we have, you know, low, simple, and fair taxes as opposed to this very complex and very uncompetitive system that we've built over the last 100 years.
So it's not, well, let me ask it this way then. The goal, at the end of all of this, the goal would be to give people an income tax cut, to cut spending if you're going to cut revenue, and if so, how are you going to make up the difference, unless I'm missing something, if it's not revenue neutral?
Sure. So right now, the way that we have it, we have our the structure for our severance tax, like mineral revenue from oil and gas, and our corporate collections from our corporate income and corporate franchise tax, they all basically go into an account. Any amounts over $600 million go into this, basically, it's kind of a savings account. We can spend it if we want to, but the idea is that it give more flexibility from that in that account and use some of that extra money to give tax cuts. So that's where most of the net loss comes from. Mm-hmm. There is a reduction of $100 million or so dollars from the general fund, and that's going to have to be worked out as kind of these bills come through the process about exactly how much money that, you know, we're willing to accept in a revenue loss, because there will be some spending cuts associated with that. But at the end of the day, it's really to make the state more competitive and eventually grow. And I think that's been kind of the struggle in Louisiana for a very long time, is that we basically fight over these shrinking pieces of the pie instead of trying to grow the pie. And so this whole plan would take us basically from the bottom in tax policy and business climate to the top of the list across the states. So it really would be kind of a sea change in how Louisiana does business. And I think you're going to see significant growth from that.
You know, one thing I realize, we've got to take a break here, but when you talk about taxing grass cutting services, we see so many, no disrespect to anybody, but we see so many services where people are driving around with lawnmowers on trailers and this grass cutting service or that grass cutting service. As it stands now, they pay income tax, but they pay no or collect no sales tax for the state on that service. And that's one of the things you're going to tax, Richard? or looking to tax?
Yeah, so, I mean, it's the same, I think, with, you know, somebody that sells bracelets out of their garage. Right now, they're subject to the sales tax. And, I mean, if they're selling, you know, a couple of bracelets, then it's not really a big deal. I mean, I think there's always people that may or may not, you know, collect the tax that they're, mm-hmm. they're supposed to collect. But really, most of the thing is, most of the sales come from, like, for a retailer, it's like Walmart or, a few big operations. And I think it's the same with almost all of those services, including, you know, landscaping. It's going to be mostly big, you know, big commercial operations that you would get most of the revenue from. And I think it's the same with any aspect of the sales tax.
All right, let me take a break. When we come back, I want to talk about inventory tax and what Representative Boeheim had to say yesterday about St. Bernard Parish. Also, we'll talk about film credits. 7:51, 9 till 8, traffic now, WWO. All right, 7:57, couple of minutes left with Richard Nelson, Louisiana Revenue Secretary. Richard, when it comes to the inventory tax, man, I've been talking about this a lot, trying to understand. Representative Boeheim said St. Bernard's, he said, spoiler alert, or quote him, they're going to opt out of it. So I don't understand how, if parishes have the ability to opt out, how that's really going to help. Take me through that process with the inventory tax.
Sure. So the inventory tax is one of the most uncompetitive taxes we have. So Louisiana is only one of only a few states that taxes business inventory. That means that basically when, you know, you have a can of SpaghettiOs on the shelf at Walmart, there's a property tax that gets levied on that. Same thing as if there's a car at a car dealer, mm-hmm. he gets charged property tax for having the car sitting on the lot. Even though there'll be sales tax when it's sold, but just sitting on the lot, you get a property tax. And so that applies to every business in the state. We're one of the only states that have it, and it's very uncompetitive way of raising revenue, right? So the inventory tax, what we're proposing is to let local governments actually opt out of levying that. So currently there's no exemption for business property for business inventory. And so we would basically create that through the constitutional amendment, allow locals to just opt out of levying that tax, which would make them much more competitive for attracting business and industry and bringing good jobs here. And so and in order to do that, we actually give them an incentive, and we offer them up to 3 years of their collections or $15 million to make that election. And so I think a lot of parishes are interested. I think a lot of parishes recognize kind of the uncompetitive.
The end result, I'm looking at the clock here, Richard, the end result is you're going to have parish competing against parish for business, accurate?
To some extent that will happen. I mean, but right now it's just all Louisiana is losing the competition with other states who don't levy the tax.
And real quick, let me get the film tax credits, because I was talking to Jason Wagensback yesterday. He was talking about what an economic boon it was to the state. Your thoughts on this?
You know, the film program, we treated just like all of our other credit incentive programs, and that we thought that they needed to have a deeper review. And so we sunset them all starting in June 30th of next year. And basically just to have a deeper review, because the taxpayers really don't get a very good return. It's about 10 cents on the dollar or less. And so we're trying to make sure that, you know, we run the state more like a business to give the taxpayers the best bang for their buck.
Thank you. I appreciate your time, Richard Nelson. I hope you come back. Ronald Surpass joins us as we come back. There's some shenanigans going on with the promotion process in New Orleans Parish with NOPD.
The holidays are all about sharing with family. Meals, couches, stories, grandma's secret pecan pie recipe. And now you can also share a cart with Instacart's family carts. Everyone can add what they want to one group cart from wherever they are. So you don't have to go from room to room to find out who wants cranberry sauce or who should get mini marshmallows for the yams or collecting votes for sugar cookies versus shortbread. Just share a cart and then share the meals and the moments. Download the Instacart app and get delivery in as fast as 30 minutes. Plus enjoy free delivery on your first three orders. Service fees and terms apply.
I'm Jenna Fisher.
And I'm Angela Kinsey.
And together we have the podcast Office Ladies.
Just because we finished rewatching The Office does not mean we're going anywhere.
Every Wednesday, we'll be sharing even more exclusive stories from The Office and our friendship with brand new guests. Plus, you can revisit all the Office Ladies rewatch episodes every Monday with new bonus tidbits before every episode.
So follow and listen to Office Ladies on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
8:22, Tommy Tucker, WWL, joined by Ollie Cosell, a credentialed Pelicans reporter. Man, things can go south quickly. I don't know what's going on Airline Drive with the hamstrings. I don't know if they're using the wrong kind of floor wax and people are slipping. I don't know what it is, but it's been devastating. How you doing, Ollie?
I've been better, but I'll tell you what, the Pelicans are much worse. Right? I mean, you just listed the injuries. It's ridiculous, the amount.
Tell for people that don't know, how bad are the injuries right now? Can you go through the list for us?
Yeah, sure. So they just received Trey Murphy. He returned, played his first game of the season against the Brooklyn Nets, so he's back. But the problem is you're still missing six players, including the newest casualty, Jose Alvarado, who sustained a hamstring injury, and the thought is he'll miss 4 to 6 weeks. So that's almost the same boat that Zion Williamson is in, also a hamstring injury. People are thinking he's going to roughly miss about the same time. And then, of course, you've got Jordan Hawkins, who's out with a sore back. He's had a lot of back spasms before the Pelicans decided to give him about a 1 to 2 week break, and that just began. So he's likely out for at least another week. DeJounte Murray broke his hand in that open seasoning game against the Bulls. He's been out, and he's going to stay out probably for another 3 to 4 weeks. And then Herb Jones and C.J. McCollum, you're hoping to get back probably the soonest. They sustained injuries during that first week of the season. It looks like their returns are back, should be around, I would say, about a week, week and a half away. So the Pelicans will get some guys back. But again, Tommy, they've already dug themselves such a hole, right? Lost 8 of their last 9 games. And now the difficult part of the schedule is coming, right? It was easier previously. Now I don't know how they're going to get through this.
So let's talk about, you know, because I get texts from people, whether it's a tax plan, whether this, they think because this, then therefore, then that's not always the way it worked. They call it the post-hoc ergo propter hoc fallacy. I don't want to get too deep into that. But why, comparing the Pelicans to other NBA teams, do the Pelicans have a lot more hamstring injuries than other teams do?
Well, this season, certainly, right? It seems like every year there's a team or two that really gets eradicated, right? Their roster with injuries. And so far, it looks like it's the Pelicans. And I've heard various theories on this. A lot of people want to first point, right, the finger at the actual medical staff. But look, New Orleans has undergone a lot of changes over the last 3 or 4 years, and Gail Benson has sunk in a lot of money to revamp that entire section. And you've got now people in positions where you used to not have any, right? If you go back to the days of Dell Demps, where it's just a handful of personnel or so. Now, this staff rivals what some of the league's best franchises and their medical staffs have. So you can't really point the finger there, like I said. I think what I'm hearing from and talking to former players is the fact that the Pelicans had such a soft preseason. They only played 3 exhibition games, and a lot of players didn't even play the full 3. So you're coming into a season where you're not going to be at optimal game shape. And then all of a sudden you're going to be playing 4 games per week in addition to practices. Like I said, that seems to be the most prevalent idea, because the Dallas Mavericks, Tommy, suffered something similar a couple of years ago. They missed close to 170 games. They also only played 3 preseason games. So I think there's some credence to that side.
People, you know, are texting in saying that they're saving Zion, that he could play. They're just kind of keeping him quiet to save him for later on in the season. But would they not be playing him if he was healthy?
They would be. Yeah, I'm not buying any of that. Being close to the team, I've heard that he actually did feel something right before last week. And coming off the Indiana Pacers game, right, everybody didn't expect for this to happen. He came in the next day. Again, nothing was said. But then right before the following game, I think it was against the Hawks, he mentioned the medical staff when he entered the building. And since then, yeah, his hamstrings have been problematic. And it shouldn't be a surprise, right? I mean, this is a player who's had hamstring issues going all the way back to college, but specifically the last 2 years.
Is it always the same one, Ollie, or is it both legs?
It's both hamstrings now are giving him problems. And look, Tommy, all you got to do is see there's a guy that's playing well, carrying a lot more weight than any other NBA player. And if he's not in pristine shape, right, doing everything he can to avoid injuries, well, chances are he's more likely to sustain a soft tissue injury than somebody else.
So how big of a hole are the Pelicans in right now?
Yeah, it's not looking good. I mean, if they were in the Eastern Conference, they'd be fine, right? There's just really 2 clear runaway teams that are playing really well. But in the West, the first top 10 teams are all over 500, and Pelicans are sitting 3-8, and they're kind of headed for a season start that reminds you of Willie Green when he first took over the team. The team got off to, what was it, a 3-16 start, and even though they made the play-in tournament in the playoffs, they entered the play-in tournament 10 games under 500. Everybody's thinking that, first, that's not likely to happen again because teams are just better, right? The parity's better across the board. You're going to have to finish with a better regular season just to make the play-in tournament. And second of all, is it even worth it, right? It's a deep draft. Pelicans have their own draft pick plus a Milwaukee first-round pick. So they could conceivably grab two lottery picks in the upcoming draft that's considered to be one of the best in the last 10 years. So there's that thought.
So give me who's likely to return first? What is the progression of players returning likely to look like?
Yeah, so I think everybody's expecting C.J. McCollum probably to return first, and then Jordan Hawkins maybe shortly thereafter. So we're looking about a week, week and a half. So miss another, say, 3 or 4 games for both of those players. And then Herb Jones is going to be right behind them. But after that, DeJounte Murray, Jose Alvarado, Zion Williamson, they're probably also going to be out for at least a month.
Bright spot to go out on?
Bright spot is the fact that the Pelicans drafted well at the last draft, and they found themselves, I think, their future center, Eve Missy. He hasn't been consistent, but this last game set a career high in points, rebounds, and you saw how he can basically impact the game. Rim running, defending the rim, something they haven't had, something that you need in today's game. And he's only 20 years old. He's going to grow and become much better at everything. Right? But he's already shown the elite footwork, ability to even guard, you know, small guards when needed. So he's going to fit right in this modern style NBA and be basically the type of center Pelicans haven't seen since, I want to say, Tyson Chandler.
And with all this talk of Brandon Ingram before the season, he's the one that's playing.
Yeah, isn't that crazy? Isn't that funny how that works? But I'll tell you what, he needs help. If there's one thing we've learned, Tommy, he's not a true number one. So when other teams send double teams at him, he can't score. He suddenly disappears, and that's what's happened. Three of these winnable games of late, the Nets, Hawks, Portland Trailblazers, he had fantastic first halves. Then he starts sending double teams in the second half. He was quiet, and the Pelicans lost all three of those games.
Thank you, Ollie. Appreciate your time. Ollie Cosell, credentialed Pelicans reporter. We'll take a break. Talk to Jeff Nowak, Saints sideline reporter, about the Saints' resurrection. Right now, time for WWL First News. 844, 16 till 9. Tommy Tucker, WWL, joined by Jeff Nowak, WWL Saints sideline reporter. Jeff, I called it a resurrection with Coach Coach Rizzi. Please feel free to use that if you like. You can have it. Take it. It's yours. Tell me on the sideline, I want to talk to you about this because you get a different sense than you do watching it on TV, even in the stands or the press box. What was your sense of the difference in the Saints team on Sunday under Coach Rizzi?
Well, I mean, you know, it's tough because, yeah, you can compare, okay, yeah, you're winning a game to you're in the seventh game of a losing streak, and the emotion and energy is going to be a little bit different. Mm-hmm. But, no, I think it started at the beginning of the game. It started in the week leading up to the game. I think people were a little more locked in. They were a little more, I don't know, emotionally charged. You know, they changed a lot of things building up to the game, and I think, you know, the goal was to kind of give things a fresh feeling, to kind of make it almost like, hey, this is an 8-game season. And that's kind of how it felt. It felt more like a week one than a week 10, if that makes sense, right? Like, and you know, you don't get to do that in the NFL, right? The first 9 weeks count. You can't just say, hey, well, we're going to see what happens from here. But, you know, at the same time, you know, you have to prove that you have something. And I think that's kind of what that was. And yeah, I mean, when things are going well for you, you're going to get hyped. And I think, you know, when you preach all week accountability and we're going to play clean quality football and you go out there and do it. So the energy was there and it's good to see. You know, it's difficult to watch any team. I mean, think about it in any context. You go 2 months at what you do for a living and you don't succeed one time. That's just not good for you. That's not good for your soul, right? Like, that's just bad. It's bad business. It's a bad experience. So I think that there, it was kind of like a level of tension kind of breaking and everyone kind of was playing a little freer, I think, and behaving a little freer, I think. But that's a challenge, right? Because I think it's a lot easier to do that in 1 week than it will be to do that for the final 2 months of the season.
You're reading ahead, Jeff Nowak. You're reading ahead because that was my next question. It's one thing to do it for 1 week, but to sustain it. Continue, please.
Yeah, no, I mean, and that's going to be the challenge for Rizzi. I think, you know, Mickey came on WWE yesterday and he kind of said this, like, you know, you can get guys to lock in for that 1 week. Can you do it for the rest of the season? And I think that's going to be the challenge because you're not going to be able to change practice schedules every week and do all these things to kind of eliminate that Groundhog Day feeling. You gotta lock in and you gotta get guys doing things the right way. And now what Darren said and what I think is correct is, you know, you don't have, you can make things, you can change things up. You can make things feel different. So you can cut through that monotony and, you know, that feeling like you're bashing your head against the wall. Winning games makes that a lot easier to do. But we'll have to see, right? That's going to be something that we watch this week. If we see a team come out and look completely flat against the Browns, all these good vibes are going to go away just as quickly as they arrived, right? So, you know, I think that's, it's really exciting and it's fun to watch a team win a game. I think people need to kind of pump the brakes a little bit on, wow, everything's fixed. The one problem is gone, and now we're back to where we need to be. There's a lot of things this football team needs to figure out, and that's going to happen over the course of the next 2 months.
And I don't say this to be a jerk, but I think what you're talking about is gimmicks as opposed to substantive change, right?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't use the term gimmicks.
But here's what I mean. If it's a one-off, then maybe it is a gimmick. That's all I'm saying. We don't know that right now.
Something like, you know, I would use the term superficial, right? Like something like changing sides of the field in practice, right? That's not something that's like, well, we were better because the offense was over there and the defense. No, it was just something that was a superficial change to kind of give the image of, hey, I'm doing this a little differently. And there's superficial things, and then there's more tangible things like changing the stretch period into an activation period, which is a little more scientific and mimics more of what you're going to be doing in practice to try to cut down on soft tissue injuries, right? There's reorganizing the locker room so that position groups are with each other so they can kind of build that bond and you feel like that's going to be a more conducive way to get the locker room headed the direction you want it, stuff like that. But, yeah, I mean, there's stuff you could do in the first week that you're not going to be able to do every week. Like, you're not going to be able to get that kind of charge of emotional energy that you were after the firing, because everyone's kind of locked in and saying like, hey, okay, this is the wake-up call we needed. But hey, maybe you can lean into that more, and that's what I'm hoping happens. And if you can win this game on Sunday against the Browns, I think you actually do have something, because you're going to go into a bye week with a lot of positivity, and then you're going to come back and face a Rams team that's a very good team that the Saints defense had a lot of trouble with last year. I think this is going to be kind of the where the rubber meets the road for Riz. But, you know, you got to get that first win before we even have this conversation. So it's a big thing for them to go out there and beat the Falcons. It really is. But it's only the first step on that road.
The Rams last year, I remember watching one drive. It seemed like I was watching a Mardi Gras parade because I was just sitting there and the whole offense just went by. You know what I'm saying? 850.
Yeah.
That's what it seemed like. It honestly did. It's like, well, okay, here comes the offense. Oh, and there they go. And, all right, we've seen it. It's over. Let's go home. 8:51, 9 till 9. More with Jeff Nowak when we come back. Time now, WWL traffic. 8:56 and a half. Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Jeff Nowak, WWL Saints sideline reporter. Jeff, tell me about these Cleveland Browns. You know, for one thing I wanted to say that resonated with me, you talk about you can't just ignore what happened and say it's a new season from here on in. I guess because the weather's been so warm, it's hard to believe that it's week 11 already. You there? Jeff, you got me muted? Jeff Nowak, you got me muted or not?
Yeah, sorry about that.
That's all right. No, but it is hard to believe that it's week 11, isn't it?
Yeah, the weather isn't exactly making us feel like it's Christmas season, let's put it that way. But yeah, the Browns are coming in. Jameis Winston's their quarterback. It's another team that's had a lot of early season struggles and kind of started to sort some things out. Obviously, they beat the Ravens, had a kind of down week the following week. But Jameis Winston's going to be their quarterback. I'm sure he's going to have some motivation to come in here and put one on his former team. The guy I'm more concerned about is Myles Garrett. You know, he's just a behemoth. He's one of the toughest matchups you'll have in the NFL in terms of an edge rusher. So, you know, the Saints should be getting Eric McCoy back. That'll be a boost, I think. But, you know, if they can block up the Browns defensive line, I like their chances in that matchup. And yeah, it'd be nice to turn that losing streak and turn around into something of a winning streak and have some sustained positivity, because that's just what we haven't had in the last 3 years is a nice long winning streak to make the fans feel like things are heading in the right direction. So that would be nice to start this week.
And to be clear, a lot had to go in their favor for them to beat the Falcons. I mean, you look at Younghoe Koo, right? Who saw that coming?
Yeah, I mean, that's the case. You know, that's the thing. The margins are so small in the NFL, right? Mm-hmm. Like, if he doesn't make a 58-yard field goal in week four, you're 3-1. And who knows how things go from there. So yeah, that's why it is difficult to go on a winning streak, because, you know, a bounce of the ball the other way and suddenly it's a 24-20 game instead of a 20-17 win. But that's why those, you know, showing up in the big moments is important, and you can play as good as you want. If you don't show up in the fourth quarter, the way the Saints did on Sunday, you're going to lose football games. And that to me was the biggest difference. We can talk about energy. We can talk about whatever. We can talk about practice schedule. But making the big plays in the fourth quarter is what won you that game. And that's what they haven't done. It's what the Saints haven't done, particularly at defense, over the first 9 weeks. So hopefully that continues.
Thank you, Jeff. Appreciate your time as always. Jeff Nowak, WWL Saints sideline reporter. We come back, we're going to talk to Matt Brown, publisher of the Extra Points newsletter. Republicans likely having control of the House, Senate, and presidency. There could be even more changes coming in college athletics. We'll talk about that. Name, image, and likeness, transfer portal, all that stuff, and how college sports have changed when we return. If you have any questions, 504-260-1870. There are no dumb questions when it comes to this, because it can be terribly confusing. Tommy Tucker back in a flash, WWL.
I'm Jenna Fisher.
And I'm Angela Kinsey.
And together we have the podcast Office Ladies.
Just because we finished rewatching The Office does not mean we're going anywhere.
Every Wednesday, we'll be sharing even more exclusive stories from The Office and our friendship with brand new guests. Plus, you can revisit all the Office Ladies rewatch episodes every Monday with new bonus tidbits before every episode.
So follow and listen to Office Ladies on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
Why get all your holiday decorations delivered through Instacart? Because maybe you only bought two wreaths, but you have 12 windows. Or maybe your toddler got very eager with the advent calendar. Or maybe the inflatable snowman didn't make it through the snowstorm. Or maybe the twinkle lights aren't twinkling. Whatever the reason, this season, Instacart's here for hosts and their whole holiday haul. Get decorations from the Home Depot, CVS, and more through Instacart and enjoy free delivery on your first three orders. Service fees and terms apply.
All right, thanks, guys. We appreciate it. Now we're joined by our guest, Matt Brown, publisher of the Extra Points newsletter. How you doing, Matt?
I'm doing very well. Thanks for having me on today, Tommy.
Thanks for taking the time. Tell me about your newsletter.
So I run a newsletter called Extra Points, which publishes original reporting and analysis of off-the-field stories that shape college athletics. And that includes everything from NIL to television deals to conference realignment, and then increasingly, and I think especially over these next couple of weeks, the potential impact of political changes on higher education and college sports specifically.
Let's give some background, if we can, about the House settlement, and this is not the House of Representatives, to be clear, and where that case plays into all of this with paying college athletes.
And it's an important distinction to make, especially because I think the House of Representatives will also become involved in this settlement and potentially other major college cases and reform efforts here in the next couple of months. But the House settlement stems from a large class action lawsuit brought by it's named for a former swimmer at Arizona State, but it includes thousands of football, basketball, and other athletes who said that they were denied financial compensation because they weren't allowed to participate in NIL when they were in school, and that they were not allowed to share from any of the revenues from broadcast television, from their NIL use in television broadcasts during their time. Had the NCAA gone to court, they probably would have lost, And the damages then would have tripled. So we're looking at $5-6 billion in potential damages. Mm-hmm. This case would have bankrupted the entire organization. So they have sought to settle. That settlement has been was issued a preliminary approval, but is not completely finalized, as athletes can potentially opt out, and other entities could issue objections, and the whole process could still be altered and likely won't be finalized until April. But the settlement terms as they currently stand require schools to give back penalties to those previous athletes. That will come out of NCAA distributions, March Madness television money. But schools will get less to go pay for these back damages. They will the settlement will allow schools, if they want to, if they opt in, to directly share up to $20 million and change of direct revenue with athletes. They can sign athletes to NIL deals themselves. And then there will be new roster limits rather than scholarship limits for a variety of sports, which will change the number of players that can be on a team from everything from football to swimming to volleyball.
Wow. I don't even know where to start unpacking all of that. First of all, did you say the number was 28? No, wait, 2 billion? How much was the number? They said 2.8
billion? Well, so for the total damages, had they not gone to trial, would have tripled, which is what happens in antitrust cases. So I believe it was north of 5 billion. This settlement, in total, will be over $1 billion, but it's spread out over 10 years. But so even, everybody's going to be paying a lot of money.
But even that, as much money as that is, if you look at the number of college athletes who would have a claim or a case, right, for not being compensated,
yeah,
is that going to wind up being one of those class actions where everybody gets $20?
They're going to get more than $20, but, I mean, the attorneys are going to get more of the money. There's going to be some football and basketball players that are a member of the class, maybe people who played in 2017, 2018. They might get $100,000. They might get a little bit more than that. They'll get a real check. There's going to be some volleyball players that might get $18. But it's going to be even more important for the athletes moving forward, because it will mean that a school like LSU or Georgia or Alabama, rather than having to depend completely on a collective, an outside entity to pay athletes directly, the school can do that up to this $20 million-ish, you know, salary cap. So current athletes could be in a position to make more cash and more cash directly than they've ever made before.
I was watching the game on LSU-Alabama on Saturday night. My mind wandered a little because, you know, it wasn't much of a game. And I was
justifiably.
And I was just looking at the sidelines, and I was thinking, well, if you talk about scholarship limits with name, image, and likeness, and this is going to what you just said, where do scholarships really factor into this? Because does the NCAA currently limit how many players you can have on the roster, or can you have as many walk-ons as you want? And if you got somebody that's there for name, image, and likeness, well, the sponsor, whatever you want to call them, could be paying their tuition. So in essence, it's a scholarship, but it really isn't, right?
Yeah, so that happens a little bit right now. The way it's set up for football is the NCAA says you can have up to 85 scholarships. They're all full rides at the FBS level. You can't divide them.
So just to be clear, we're not talking about roster spots. We're talking about scholarships, right?
Yeah, right. No, actually, we're talking about different things. So, okay. But it's going to change.
Right.
So let me try to back up. As of today, on the LSU football team, LSU can offer 85 full-ride scholarships, but they can have up to 120 on the roster. Now, all 120 of those players won't travel to every game, and most of them are going to be walk-ons or practice squad guys. But there's plenty of people in the official team photo that are not on full scholarship. What's going to happen after the House case, if it is approved as currently structured, is LSU can only have 105 dudes on that team. And whether LSU wants to give all 105 full-ride scholarships, whether they want to give 85 full ride scholarships and then have the rest of the people be walk-ons, that's up to them. Mm-hmm. The SEC earlier this week said, hey, for the first year as a conference, we're going to stick to 85 scholarships and you'll just have a smaller number of walk-ons. But that could change in a year or two. Other schools could potentially decide to go more. That will be one of the conversations each athletic department has to have. And maybe one reason why you would offer fewer scholarships is for that exact reason. If we can go get the collective or somebody else to pay the tuition, we could save the proverbial salary cap room for somebody else.
So where do tuitions fit in with salary? Because it is an intaxable income. If the colleges are going to, and you have to go slow with me here because my eyes tend to glaze over. Matt,
so
LSU can have 105 guys dressed out, right? I mean, on a team, They can choose to travel with however many they want. They're probably not going to take all 105. They can have 105 on scholarship if they want. As this changes,
if the House settlement is approved, they could. The SEC central office has said, "Hey, because we're trying to recruit for next year, and we don't know if this settlement's going to get approved until April, and that's not enough time." For next season, let's stick to 85. But for 26, 27, 28, they could theoretically move that up up to 105.
And how does the model change from name, image, and likeness? Tell you what, this might be a good time to stop and digest what we've heard so far. And
I know it's
about,
a lot.
Yeah, it is. And name, image, and likeness to schools directly paying players. And if that's the case, I don't know if a scholarship is currently taxable or not. Does that become taxable income? Or does the school choose to pay the player and then a player pays tuition? I don't know. We'll talk more when we come back. If you've got any questions about this, I don't blame you because it's very complicated. Matt Brown, publisher of the Extra Points newsletter, talking about the changes in college sports, which, like it or not, are here. And one thing I do want Matt to talk about when we come back, because he always does, is the fallacy that college athletes have never been paid. Because, Matt, bring it back for a second, Tim. Matt, this goes back to what, the 20s?
At least, and really before then,
And I always look at college football starting in the 20s, when in fact it was before that because they have 100th anniversary of games. We'll be back in a flash. Tommy Tucker, WWL. All right, 9:26, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to our friend Matt Brown, publisher of the Extra Points newsletter, about the House case, which is not to be confused with the House of Representatives. It's about, correct me if I say anything inaccurate here, because I'm going to try to sum it up, Matt. It's about a college swimmer, a class action suit that was a lot of other people joined onto. It's about college athletes who say, wait a minute, the equivalent in a way of Reggie Bush getting his Heisman Trophy back, where it's like, well, wait a minute. You didn't pay me now because you said it was illegal. Now you're paying other college players. Where's my money? Accurate?
That's good enough for radio, my friend.
All right,
yeah,
okay.
That's
yeah,
exactly accurate.
You could have a briefs that fill a room, I would think, of this case. So when it comes now to colleges directly paying players and scholarships as opposed to they can have 105 players, say, for football. Let me get back to the class action case for a minute. When you said volleyball players could be paying getting checks of $18, basketball players $100,000, how are they going to decide who gets what based on what?
That's a great question. So you have two different pots of money. You have the money that you're paying for back penalties for athletes who have previously competed, and you have the money you're going to pay current athletes. And the exact formula for how the previous athletes are going to be paid is one of the things that's still being worked out and finalized and argued over the coming months. So that's part of why this settlement isn't completely 100% approved. But the way that people in the industry are talking about it and the way that the plaintiff's attorneys are talking about it is that the formula will skew towards who is on TV the most, who drove the most financial value, which would mean that 90% of that back pay would go to football and men's basketball players. Those are the individuals that have been on TV and drive the value for the largest television contracts. Schools will have the ability to decide how they want to share that money moving forward between all of their athletes. One of the difficult questions that schools are still grappling with is, what does it mean to be Title IX compliant and how we directly share revenue with athletes? Do we only have to pay the same number of men and women, but not the same amount of money? Do we have to share the same amount of money? Is there no Title IX component to any of this because it's not educational funds or opportunities? And the answer is nobody knows, because the White House hasn't told us, and now we have a new White House. Mm-hmm. And so everyone's kind of flying blind until there's a lawsuit and a judge clarifies it.
Wow, so many questions. So
I know
when it comes to colleges directly paying athletes, are we on, I mean, like, just, you know, not a scholarship, not a grant in aid, as they used to call it, none of that. It's like, okay, look, you come play here. I guess, according to the NCAA, you'd, and this may sound ridiculous, but you'd have to be enrolled in school. Although now, if you look at it, if you look at Joe Burrow's last year at LSU, I think he was in graduate school, took one course, and that was online. So the only time he set foot on campus, as I remember it, was to go to football practice. So I guess you would still have to be enrolled in school or not. I don't know.
So these are actually good questions. And the way that it's set up right now, which could always change, the way that it's set up moving forward, is that you still have the scholarship and grant and aid package, and then you have money that's directly from the school that's on top of that. You have to realize that when you get a full-ride athletic scholarship, whether it's to play football at LSU or volleyball at Tulane or anybody else, you're not just getting tuition. You're also getting room and board. You're getting food, and college athletes need more food than you and I do. Mm-hmm. You're getting an apartment or a dorm. You're getting the training table. You're getting health insurance. You're getting some of these extra things.
Healthcare, health care, right?
Academic tutoring, maybe even some cash in the form of Alston payments. So the total financial value of that entire package could be north of six figures. And right now, it's not taxable.
Ah.
In the event that some athletes are made employees, which may or may not happen in the future, and that becomes part of the benefits of an employee compensation package, then it could be, would become taxable, and then that changes things. Then you have, so that's, as of right now, like nothing, the current status quo for what the school can give for a scholarship package, that doesn't change. The house money is extra, because then a school for the first time could say, hey, we just sold this new advertising deal with Learfield, where we're going to put Joe Burrow's face, assuming, you know, pretending Joe Burrow is still the quarterback, on a bunch of billboards in his LSU stuff to promote LSU tickets. And because Joe Burrow's face is on there, we're going to pay Joe $50,000 for that advertising campaign. They couldn't do that before. Now they can, and then Joe would pay taxes on that because that's income. Rather than 50 grand for LSU football players, that number might end up being $220,000, could be 270. They could still get their own deals. But you kind of have to treat this as a separate pot of money that now the university and sport general managers have to figure out the best way to both legally and efficiently share with their athletic, with their players.
If,
I know.
Yeah. Yeah. So, again, I'm going to ask, and maybe you answered me, and maybe I just didn't get it, and I'm not trying to badger the witness, Your Honor, but...
No, it's okay.
If the House settlement is approved, and we'll get to what would that could mean, what that would entail in a minute, or what would that have to happen for that to occur, would colleges then directly pay players or not?
Yeah, they could. And so, and here's the interesting thing. They don't have to. Each individual school has the option to opt into the settlement terms or not. LSU, assuredly, as would everybody in the SEC, absolutely would.
Because otherwise they open themselves up to further litigation, right?
But not just potential litigation, but also how could you possibly recruit against Alabama? If Alabama says, we opted in and we're going to directly cut our players a $200,000 check in addition to everything else, and LSU isn't, and the SEC... you would be completely uncompetitive. The more interesting question is, what does McNeese do? Mm-hmm. What does CELA do? What do some of these Southland institutions do? Because the settlement might say, hey, you are permitted to share up to $20 million in athletic revenue. And then maybe McNeese goes and they look at the budget and they go, brother, we don't make $20 million. Right. I can't share what we don't have. And so maybe they opt in. Maybe they don't.
All right, so came upon that $20, $21 million. How? Where'd that number come from?
That's a great question. A cynic might say, out of thin air. Mm-hmm. A less cynical person would say they came to that number by trying to approximate a 50-50 split between institutions and players, but they were counting all of the money that's spent on scholarships and training tables and grant and aids and everything else as to the players. And so the difference is this, you know, across the major schools is $20 million. Whether that's true or not, I couldn't tell you because I'm not working from the same spreadsheets that these attorneys are.
What would effect would this have on HBCUs?
A very good question. Because
well, that's why I'm here,
sure
man.
Many of you,
gave me the job because occasionally I come up with a good one every now and then.
Right, and as I'm sure your listeners are aware, HBCUs in this country are not blessed with anywhere close to the same athletic or institutional financial resources as their PWI and state flagship peers. So there's one school of thought that says the HBCUs simply won't opt in. And they'll say, listen, we all know what Alcorn's budget is. I was actually just looking at it before we hopped on the call here for another project. We don't have the money to share with those athletes. We want to have larger rosters because we want to increase to like enrollment for our schools. We're not going to do it. And if a player decides to go to LSU over, you know, FAMU, that's fine because FAMU was never going to win that battle anyway. They could do that. They could decide to opt in and then just share a very small amount of money. They might say, listen, we're not going to give you any of our current money, but if we sell new sponsorship revenue together, we'll cut you a deal on that. And that's something that a lot of low majors are telling me and telling their commissioners they are going to do. We're not going to share any new cash because we don't have it, but we'll opt into the settlement so we have the mechanism to do it before. But it is difficult for me to see any of this as a way to level the playing field in competition. I think this is another thing that the richest schools will be able to handle and the middle and lower class of schools really won't.
Surprisingly, only 22 players made the cut in the entire NFL. That was as of August 27th. I don't know what the number is now, but only 22 players in the NFL represent HBCUs. I thought the number would be higher than that, but there is also a thought that the way college football has changed, that has already hurt HBCUs and their programs. Accurate?
Yeah, I mean, we're never going to go back to the days in the 60s mm-hmm. when you would send 8 dudes from Jackson State every year to the NFL, because those players are not limited to just a handful of Northern schools and HBCUs. And that's true not just for athletes, right? That's true for talented students. Our talented black students all over the country may and do decide to go to LSU, to Tulane, to Texas, all over. And so the recruiting ground for HBCUs is different. Not just setting aside all of the ways that those schools have been shortchanged as institutions over the last couple of decades, I think it is a difficult recruiting pitch to tell somebody who could go to a big-time Division I institution, you should come here where you won't have the resources, you won't be on television as much, you won't have some of the same academic bells and whistles or facility bells and whistles just because this is where your parents went. Other reasons. Some players will do that, but the financial gap is just enormous for most of those schools.
How important are athletic programs to HBCUs?
I think deeply for many of them, right? You know, part of this is the trope that you hear in higher education administration circles is that college sports is the front porch of the university. Mm-hmm. And maybe that gets overstated a little bit, but there really is a lot of truth to it, particularly for HBCUs. One of the biggest ways you get alumni to come back on campus, to come back and give both money and time and remain affiliated, that's at homecoming. And that's in a different culture in a different way than it is for many PWIs or other state institutions. A way to remain relevant in your state house, to remain relevant and constantly communicating with your community is through sports. And I actually think that's even more true for some smaller HBCUs that are in the CIAA or playing Division II, where those events have an outsized cultural influence. The way to keep HBCUs at the Division I level competitive and engaged and part of this whole process is really difficult. It's part of the reason why some congressional bills in the last Senate over NIL regulation fell apart. It was specifically over how to include HBCUs in that mix.
Let me take a break. We'll get some more questions from the text line, 504-260-1870. We're talking to Matt Brown, I'm sorry, the publisher of the Extra Points newsletter about this House settlement, and then I want to talk about Ted Cruz and his reelection, what role that could have in this, and what he had to say, National Labor Relations Board. So many questions are coming in. And also what effect this would have on different sports at different schools. If you have any questions, 504-260-1870. The newsletter again, Matt, if people want to subscribe and really dig deep into this.
You can find it at extrapointsmb.com. If you're in the great state of Louisiana, this is a newsletter that's read by folks in the administration and coaching staff at LSU and Tulane and the University of New Orleans and all throughout the region and multiple conference offices. If you want to read what they're reading, you can subscribe for free at extrapointsmb.com.
And I know you're not from here, but for people that don't want this to happen, the parade has already passed. Now we're just cleaning up after, right? Accurate?
Yes.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah. I would say that's 90% accurate.
All right. 9:40, 20 till 10. Traffic now. WWL. All right. Back quickly to Matt Brown, publisher of the Extra Points newsletter. I got to go back, Matt, because I'm getting some texts about this, and I'm a little bit confused myself about academic eligibility. And if you're an employee of the school, the janitor doesn't have to go to class. Well, I guess the professor does have to go to class, but he's teaching the class. The HR people don't have to go to class. Who would dictate academic requirements for these so-called, in parentheses, student athletes?
Well, if we do go to a world where athletes become employees or some athletes become employees, what will dictate that is the contract, right? The janitor's contract doesn't say that the janitor has to be an enrolled student or do anything, but there's nothing stopping the school or even a public union from making that part of the contract. I think most janitors would say that's unreasonable, and so I won't take the janitorial gig.
Yeah, but let me turn it around. If it would mean that you wouldn't get the janitor or the HR representative that you wanted, what would force you to put that in there? Who's going to enforce that the athletes are going to have to go to class?
Well, right now, the NCAA academic eligibility standards haven't changed. There's still an enforcement mechanism. If you don't make APR, if you're not making academic progress, you could still be sanctioned and removed from the postseason. Your institution still gets money for hitting particular academic benchmarks. And the House settlement doesn't change any of those things.
Right.
What potentially could be employment, which hinges on a couple of court cases and could change depending on what the Trump administration and what this new Congress decides to do. But that hasn't happened yet.
Well,
if it does, then it becomes up for negotiation.
Let's talk about that then with the NLRB and Ted Cruz and what he said about all of this. Go ahead, please.
Sure. So to kind of zoom out here for a little bit, we have a couple of legal cases working their way through that challenge the idea that college athletes, or at least some college athletes, should not be employees. We have a case centered around athletes, FCS football players in Pennsylvania. That's in district court. That's Johnson v. NCAA. We have a complaint with the National Labor Relations Board in Boston concerning Dartmouth men's basketball. And we have another one for the NLRB in Los Angeles about USC and UCLA. There's been an additional complaint filed about Notre Dame. That one hasn't been opened or started yet. And among legal observers who have, I think, looked at how the Supreme Court handled Alston and how the Supreme Court has looked at antitrust cases with the NCAA and other courts and decided, if this continues, eventually enough courts are going to say that at least football and basketball players should be employees, potentially more expansive. That's why the NCAA for several years has been lobbying Congress for a law that makes it very clear that college athletes aren't. And that's something that Congress can change over the last several years.
That college aren't employees?
Yes. That is what the NCAA and the SEC and the Big Ten would like, is a federal law that says college athletes, whether they're LSU football players or Northwestern state tennis players, are not athletes. That's what the NCAA wants.
Look at you, Northwestern
and
State.
And they haven't been able to get
Demons.
It. I'm sorry, that's right. Yeah. Right now, when we had either Democrats controlling the three bodies or we had divided government, that bill couldn't happen. It didn't even really get that close. You had Democratic lawmakers who opposed the idea of preventing athletes from seeking that status. You had Democratic lawmakers who wanted to tie that to other bills like expanding athlete health care or changing the Olympic model. You generally had more conservatives sympathetic to the NCAA, but you had some who weren't, because it will be restricting the economic earning potential of many people. The conventional wisdom now is, now that Donald Trump has won election, you know, is going to be president again, Republicans are going to have 54 Senate seats. Ted Cruz is going to be the head of the Finance Committee, and he's already signaled several times, hey, NIL reform and college athletics reform is very important to me. It's entirely possible, if not probable, that this next Congress could say, okay, new law, forget, doesn't matter what the courts say. College football players can't be employees. They have to be students. We're going to codify NCAA amateurism rules.
But that kind of sends a mixed message for a conservative, because you would think, well, then, wait a minute, it's America. You can make as much money as you want if you work hard, or it's protecting a big, giant business, right?
So, yes, and that's the conventional wisdom, and I guess I should be careful saying this in this market, but it is the truth.
Tell the truth. I mean, that's what I'm doing.
Here's the truth. You have some conservative lawmakers who I think other things are more important in some cases than access to free enterprise or capitalism, whether that might be preserving, in their view, a uniquely American institution like college athletics, whether it might be racial or cultural animosity, whether that's to higher education specifically, or not wanting to empower what they perceive to be loudmouth, immature black athletes, whether that's because they have a personal relationship with some very conservative coaches, which might be the case here with Tommy Tuberville. There's lots of reasons, right? I mean, like, tariffs aren't particularly free market, and we just elected a president who said on TV every day, yes, I'm going to position tariffs. I'm going to claw back the free market and have more regulation in other places. And that is exactly what many conservatives feel specifically about college sports.
So what's happening in sports with this whole thing, and what could happen, is a microcosm what's happening with conservative philosophy, where the old conservative thought of free enterprise and government get out of the way is free enterprise and government get out of the way, except for when I think this. Accurate?
In my professional opinion, I think that is accurate, right? And I think the most charitable way I could say that would be a conservative saying, we need free market in some places, and we need the arm of the states to be aggressive in clawing back overreach in other institutions, right? Like, we need the arm of the state to punish or claw back higher education or Hollywood or these other places.
Real quick, before I run out of time, Matt, so if...
Yeah.
They do pass a law saying that college athletes cannot be paid. What does that do with the House settlement?
Oh, the likely law isn't that college athletes can't be paid. The likely law, there's very, very few, there's a couple, but very few lawmakers now want to go back to a world where athletes can't be paid at all. What they are more likely to do is pass a law saying athletes cannot be employees. And so the House settlement will then function as something of an unnegotiated collective bargaining agreement.
And what happens with name, image, and likeness?
Precisely. And there could be some very significant clawbacks on NIL, you could have a rule where these deals have to be reported and regulated, and we can't pay a guy $200,000 to give one speech and sign one autograph. It's got to be about economic fair market value. Any of these rules will result in less money going to elite football players. I feel very confident saying that.
Say that part again.
I feel very confident that any conservative passed legislation will result in less money going to elite football players and elite men's basketball players.
But not less going
at the top end.
But not less going to the institution.
But not less going to the institution. Right. And potentially not less going to athletes, period, right? It will just mean that they're taking aim at the bagman market, which, as you and I have talked about a couple of times, has existed, particularly in this part of the country, for well over 100 years.
Matt, thank you so much. You got to come back. Never enough time. Matt Brown, publisher of the Extra Points newsletter. We'll take a quick break. Back in a flash, WWL.
I'm Jenna Fisher.
And I'm Angela Kinsey.
And together we have the podcast Office Ladies. Just because we finished rewatching The Office does not mean we're going anywhere.
Every Wednesday, we'll be sharing even more exclusive stories from The Office and our friendship with brand new guests. Plus, you can revisit all The Office Ladies rewatch episodes every Monday with new bonus tidbits before every episode.
So follow and listen to Office Ladies on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.